Nadia Bowles Weber is featured in our episode, Black and White. She's among the most interesting spiritual leaders in America today. Kelly and I caught up with Nadia, with the three of us in three different cities, Kelly in Oakland, Nadia in Denver, and I in the New York City area. But we just wanted to get a chance to get to know Nadia a little better and dig a little deeper on some of the stuff that you may have learned in the episode and some stuff you may not have learned in the episode. So welcome, Nadia, and hi, Kelly.
Hey, guys.
I was just going to say that this episode, I've been in three different neighborhood projects who have watched your piece, and I wondered if you had a sense of why people respond to you the way they do, because it is so, there's such terrific relief. As you're talking on this episode, I can see people's shoulders dropping. I can see their faces relax. Do you have a sense of why that is?
I can't remember what's on the film. What am I talking about in your film?
You're talking about the ways in which we are deeply and almost irrevocably flawed.
Oh, yeah. Well, if people are relieved when they hear that, it's because you just seldom hear the truth, I think. And I think, you know, so much of our culture is built on this notion that we can sort of self-improve ourselves into deification or something, you know, that with enough spiritual disciplines or self-care or whatever it is, listening only to Christian radio, I mean, whatever your brand is of self-improvement, I think there is this idea that it can actually work. And while I think you can have a more of a sense of well-being and you can maybe become a somewhat more balanced person who possibly does less damage to yourself and other people through those sort of practices, it doesn't mean that you're not still in some way broken. There's this guy, Francis Spufford, who wrote one of the best books I've ever read in my life called Unapologetic. And you can bleep me out if you guys have an issue with profanity, but in his book, that idea of sin is like something a lot of people just are repelled by. I think it's because a lot of people just think you're talking about some sort of immorality when you talk about sin. But he's like, no, sin is just what he calls the human propensity to fuck things up. That's all it is. That's all that is. And no one's free from that.
How surprising is it to you that you are a minister? Like, can you roll back to before religion became the central part of your life and tell us like who you are and paint a picture of yourself before the collar, if you will?
Well, religion really was the central part of my life growing up in a very sort of fundamentalist family. We went to church three times a week, and there's a lot of that religious upbringing that I really needed to reject, and that made me actually really angry. The way women were treated, the sort of exclusivity, the idea that we were the only good people, and the judgmental stuff. I mean, all the reasons people leave conservative religion. But what's also true is that I was raised in a community, and we shared our lives, and there was a divine aspect to everything that happened, and there was meaning making, and we shared our joys and our struggles. So there was something really beautiful about being raised that way too, but I couldn't actually embrace that till later in my life. I had to go through a long time of being angry about it and rejecting it. So I was raised really religious, and then I ended up really needing to separate from that. And I replaced it with a fairly sturdy drug and alcohol habit instead. And, you know, I just had years of living really recklessly and wildly. And then I was sort of struck sober. I didn't really mean to get sober. I was really convinced I'd be dead by the time I was 30, and felt okay with that. So, I mean, the fact that I'll be 50 next year is just a miracle, given the fact that I really didn't even think I'd be alive, much less be a pastor. But
how many years were you, like, so you threw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, and then you Like, how long were you on drugs and alcohol, and where in the country were you? Were you always in Denver?
Yeah, I was in Denver. So, and in California some, too. But it wasn't that long, honestly. It was only 7 years. And well, that's not that long. I mean, a lot of people
that
use
feels
for
long.
Decades.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think I have this theory. I think everyone has a certain amount of drugs and alcohol they can consume in their lifetime. And, like, I used mine up. Like, had I known, I'd maybe have paced myself. But I used mine up. But look,
what
when
was
you,
your drug of choice?
Oh, definitely alcohol. I did a lot of drugs. I did a lot of cocaine. I smoked a lot of dope. I did PCP. I mean, I did a lot of different drugs. But it was alcohol that really got my number. That was the thing that I had no control over. Yeah, not as sexy as the other things, but that was my downfall for sure.
And were your parents praying for you like crazy, or how aware were they of your lifestyle?
Yeah, I was only somewhat, but I mean, yeah, they knew. I mean, you know, I did maybe total a couple of their cars, and I mean we were pretty estranged, and I think it was obviously now. I mean, now that I'm a parent and I have college kids, you know, I have kids that age, I can't imagine how painful it was. And at the time, I was just oblivious to the fact that it was so hurtful to my parents and how terrifying it must have been. And so when people are like, you know, they're like, oh, how do your parents feel about this or that in your life, I'm like, look, I'm not dead or in prison, so everything's just a bonus to them.
Yeah.
But also, it is odd that, like, my parents actually are members of my church. So my parents now, you know, for years have come to my church. They go to their Church of Christ in the morning, and then they come to House for All Sinners and Saints at night.
Tell us about your church.
Well, it's my dad describes it as like high church at the Star Wars cantina. So it's
he's so poetic.
It's a motley crew of people who don't a lot of people who don't look like they should be in church, and then some people who do. And it's very queer. Probably a third of my congregation is gay, lesbian, transgender, or something like that. And it's very young. A lot of young adults in the church. And somehow it's like this place that people who don't fit anywhere else find a home in a way.
And was that your hope for it when you started it?
Look, I just hoped I could start a church I'd be willing to show up to, because I don't really like church. Church is mostly pretty uncomfortable for me when I have to culturally commute from who I am to who most churches are, and I can do it, but I'm just not that comfortable. You know, I'm afraid I'll say the wrong thing or make the wrong kind of joke, or I never have I don't even own the right clothes. I don't have grown-up clothes. There's just a way in which the culture around churchiness is just not a culture I feel that comfortable in.
And you're covered in tattoos.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Hey, Nadia,
how old were you when you got... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, hey, Nadia, when you think about religion, you know, there's a really boring version of what I'm about to bring up, which I don't want to have that conversation right now. Like, what's the difference between being spiritual and being religious? It's more a question of... you know, the notion of an institution at all. And, you know, institutions have needs, and institutions sometimes pull us away from kind of who we are, right? And you know, we believe in things. Like, our organization really believes in things, but our organization needs to survive. Or theoretically it does. Maybe it doesn't, but I'd prefer that it does. And that institution sometimes begins to own you. And when I think of churches, you know, there was this guy who stood on this mount some time ago and made a bunch of declarations and suggestions and sharings. And sometime later, a bunch of humans went around and built these organizations all over the place. And they did it in a whole variety of ways. Some of them you just brought up. The clothes that you're supposed to wear, the things you're supposed to do, the things you can say, the things you can't say, which the guy on the hill didn't really talk anything about. So I always wonder, you know, how does that happen and why does that happen? And I think about you sometimes and I think, how do you institutionalize Nadia? And does Nadia think that way? Or do you get afraid of the institutionalization of yourself? How do you think about that?
Oh man, yeah. The reason human institutions are so complicated is because humans are so complicated. I think we tend to think of institutions as separate from people, and yet the thing that will always be the biggest problem with church is that it's filled with people. It's never going to be Jesus. Jesus isn't going to be the problem. It's always going to be people. But it's the same with every institution, with every corporation, with every school board, with everything that humans endeavor to do will be complicated. It will forever be a mix of good and bad because human beings will forever be a mix of good and bad. And so to me, I think if the more honest we are about the fact that we are simultaneously sinner and saint, the easier it becomes to not be fooled in the sense of, like, one of the things in life I actually am the most suspicious of is idealism. It's just, it feels like a huge setup. There's a documentary series on Netflix called Wild, Wild Country about the Rajneeshpuram and, you know, this guru came out and these people who are following the guru and they start this city in Oregon. And it's just an interesting tale of human beings. And I think that if we can sort of tamp down our idealism a little bit and actually instead of idealism, just have this sort of hope, a hope that is based in reality, then sometimes we can allow our institutions to be flawed and challenge them to be better and not feel like we have to dispense with them entirely because they're not perfect in the way that we hoped they would be perfect. You know what I'm saying? Like, just that realism of human beings and institutions, I feel like, is essential. Like, in our church, people can get idealistic about House for All Sinners and Saints because they walk in, they're like, oh, this is what church is supposed to be, and it's supposed to feel like this and look like this. And so when we welcome them in our newcomers brunch, people go around the room and they say what drew them to the church or what kept them there, what they love about it. And I'm always last. And I go, look, I love all the same things you guys love about this church, but I feel like it's really important for you to hear me say something out loud. And it's this: this church will disappoint you. At some point, I will say something stupid and hurt your feelings, or we won't live up to something that we say is important to us. That will happen. And so maybe make a decision now as to whether you're going to stick around after that happens and see the way that grace actually works. Yeah. Because it's too beautiful to miss.
You know, in the film, you wear a collar for part of it. And I was there that day when we were filming, and I don't think I'd ever seen you in a collar. And I was a little afraid. You know, I was a little like, ooh, I got to behave a little better right now or something. And just to be clear, like,
I don't remember you behaving particularly well.
Well, I want to make it clear because my fourth grade teacher, Sister Ann Frederick, told me that if I sinned, I would go to hell. And hell is like putting your hand on a electric stove for eternity. And it's not what I fear. It's not. But it's about a 1/100 of 1% what I fear. It's still in there. Like, that fear stayed with me. Sure. So when I saw you in that collar that day, it might have been as high as 11%. I was like 11% afraid because all of a sudden I was like, oh, right. She's an authority figure. She's a... an other kind, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's just like when you're driving on the highway and then you see a cop.
Yeah, exactly.
And all of a sudden your posture changes and you put both hands on the wheel and you turn down the radio and there's just this sense of like I'm about to get caught for something I know I was speeding.
Right.
Wow.
And that's why I think people love you so much and so appreciate your point of view. And even the way you handle that moment with your newcomers and saying, like, guess what? It feels really good today. But, like, there's going to be a day in the future where this is not working for you, mm-hmm. where I blow it, where I hurt you.
Yeah.
And that, to me, goes to, expectation and acceptance and the idea that institutional nature is just a mirror of human nature,
mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know why that's so hard for us to get, but it really is. Mm-hmm. Like, there is an outrage with institutions that people have gotten over with human beings. Like, we're ready. I feel, I mean, I'm 50 now. I feel like I have finally internalized the fact that, like, people are good and bad and people have flaws and those flaws sometimes drive them. And therefore, I am not quite at the same risk to be deeply disappointed by a human being. But boy, do I go crazy about institutions, as if I don't know that institutions are just collections of people. So where would the flaws go? Why would they not be present in an institution, as you say?
Right, right. Well, also the locus of authority has changed so much in the last 20 years, even 10 years. I mean,
say more.
Well, I mean, institutions were something that really were developed after the Enlightenment. So when we think of institutions, you know, we think of universities and hospitals and denominations and military and banking. All of that were things, all of those institutions were just delivery systems to deliver the promises of the age of progress from the Enlightenment, right? Now that we've elevated human reason and we understand how the world works, anything's possible. And there was this idealism to that, but we needed a delivery mechanism for the promises of the age of progress. And that's what these institutions are. And then we wake up one day and we go, hold on, it seems like these institutions are actually more concerned with preserving and maintaining themselves and than they are with delivering those promises. You know, and so then you have Watergate and you have Vietnam and you have clergy sex scandals and you have the banking meltdown and you have you name it, right? You have police shootings. I mean, there's a way in which every institution has disappointed us. And I think that that has translated into what has authority anymore. Like when I'm doing media interviews these days, I'll say, look, I'm not the story. The heavily tattooed, foul-mouthed lady pastor story, that's interesting for 5 minutes tops, and that 5 minutes ended at least 4 years ago. So the story is, what's changed culturally in America that's created a situation under which I'm who people are listening to in religion? That's a more interesting story. And I think it has to do with authority in some way. What do we trust? And I think that maybe just the people sense some transparency in me. And also, like, I have this form of leadership. I don't mind talking about my shortcomings. Like, I actually believe in grace so much, it does not bother me to ever talk about how much I need it. And so people end up sort of trusting that, because in some way, every time we've peeked behind the curtain, we've never found the Wizard of Oz. We keep finding scared little men trying to pretend to be big, right? So if there's not a curtain, or if somebody's saying, no, I'm totally pulling levers and I am a scared little person, they go, oh, okay, what do you have to say to us? And so when I admit things about myself that are difficult, I do that to create a space around me where people feel safe to try and consider what those things might be for themselves and in their own lives. And ultimately, it's a form of leadership I call, well, screw it, I'll go first.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, Nadia, that, or let me put it differently, might it be the case that what you are describing is truth, and that, you know, one of the disadvantages of modern times, perhaps, depends on how you look at it, certainly one of the factors of modern times is overload. There's just way too much of it. Mm-hmm. And it is pretty shallow. It is pretty gross. Mm-hmm. It is pretty meaningless. And so when you smell some truth, because I think, like, as I'm listening to you describe this thing, you know, I was at this conference this past weekend, and I have a couple wild things that happened. I want to mention one in a couple minutes, but I was with some women from the South, and we were doing these conversations, and they talked about what they get out of the Bible and Bible conversations. And they said, you know, they're okay. They just kind of don't go all the way. And it was right after we had seen our film On Acceptance, where you meet, you know, a gay woman and a trans man and, you know, a variety of interesting people. And I said, you know, the one thing to remember is that, you know, these are the kind of people that Jesus, at least in the New Testament, suggests spent time with. And, you know, it's sort of silly that I had to remind them of that. And I'm not suggesting that they thought I was uncovering some massive piece of information, but I could totally feel their relief. I could just feel their relief in like, wow, we can be as good as we feel right now. We can celebrate this as powerfully. And all I was giving them was just a little bit better take on truth as, by the way, as I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That thing to be. And that's where when you describe this, you know, I sent a note to our, we have an event on Tuesday, and I sent out a note to say, I wrote casual dress. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at it and I thought, oh, they're going to put on the uniform. They're going to dress like all the idiots, me included, who live around here. And so I wrote another thing, you know, what actually makes you feel comfortable? And then I wrote another thing, which was, we won't judge you.
Mm.
Now, I don't know if it'll work at all or if it'll just seem like Tom was trying to like entertain us in his note. But I hoped that they would be them. Like, I'm hoping they'll come as them and not as our acceptable version of them. So I long-winded and I apologize, but I think you're this really interesting messenger of truth that might give you authority, but anyway.
Well, I think that, yeah, a lot of people have been really hurt by Christianity and have turned away from Christianity. And yet there's so much truth to be had, really perennial wisdom, I would say, in this tradition and in Jesus' teachings and in the Gospels specifically. And yet it feels like a lot of people, because of what the institution has done in trying to control people and judge people and fill them with fear, a lot of that perennial wisdom ends up being lost. And I'm like, what? God, man, I understand. I love my congregation to bits, and I love being there every week. But I understand why people don't want to go to church, like generally speaking, except for my congregation. I kind of also don't want to go to church. But the gospel, like this idea of good news and this perennial wisdom in Jesus' teachings, is so beautiful and so deeply like big T true and so liberating and such a path to freedom and so counter to so many other messages we get that I'm like, oh my gosh, why is it that the only place somebody even has like the chance of hearing the gospel is at church? It's like if the only chance you had of hearing Mozart was the dentist chair, you know, and like you have to kind of go through some fear, you know, to get there, and you might be judged for your behavior when you're sitting there and it might hurt, but like you might get to hear Mozart, you know? I'm like, this stuff is so, like the talk I gave at the Nantucket Project, I mean, there were heavy hitters at that event, right? But people were so affected by this really simple message of Jesus and forgiveness. It wasn't even original, right? It's just this big T truth, perennial wisdom in this tradition that so much of the bullshit about church has obscured.
Yeah. By the way, just to point out, it's important to know that Nadia won the audience award at our event last year. So she is right. It was quite popular. So let me ask you this then. So at the same event, I spoke, and there was 5,000 people there, and I'm not making this up, all but about 15 were women. So it was a gigantic women's gathering. And I spoke on the first day. And so throughout the next 3 or 4 days, I got stopped a lot. You know, a lot of people want to talk, which is great. A woman came up to me and she, you know, was smiley and said, I want to tell you a story. I said, okay. And the story that she told me, and I'll go quick, was my daughter has a genetic illness and she's about to die. She's 14.
Mm.
I think your talk was about God.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me that it was and tell me that you believe? And, you know, I have to say, I thought she might ask, like, where'd I get my genes? But I had no idea what she was going to ask me. I was taken aback. I had this sense of responsibility, you know, like I don't want to say anything offhanded right now. And I don't want to say anything insincere right now. Like this woman, and by the way, she added that she started reading the Bible recently and she can't believe how much it's made her feel differently. And she said, I'm not historically a religious person, But, you know, it's the first moment since my daughter's been sick, and it's been a number of years, and apparently she's 1 or 2 years from dying, that she's actually felt decent, and she wanted me to kind of validate the way she felt. So I didn't really answer her, is what happened. I half answered her, but then I wrote her a couple days later with my answer, which I think I believe, but I do think I believe. I don't want to say that with such a sense of doubt. But then I thought of you. I thought, like, how would Nadia answer that question? So partly I'm asking is, do you believe? Mm-hmm. And how do you answer that question for that mm-hmm. woman?
Well, that's it's interesting because I just don't know. There are beliefs, and then there's like faith, and I feel like those are sometimes different things. Like faith is just this mysterious thing to me, and it's like it's about connection to something that I really experience to be true, and there's no explaining it. You can't, through your reason, justify it or explain it. It's just there, and it's like almost faith is a presence. It's like a relationship to something that is present. Whereas belief is like doctrine or being able to sort of talk rationally about why you believe different things. So those are two different orders of reality in a way to me. And I think sometimes, I mean, there are times where I'm like, oh my gosh, what are the odds in this like extremely vast universe, you know? You know, the Hubble telescope images are just terrifying to me. Like I can dig like our solar system. I'm pretty good with that. Like, but when it keeps going bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, then I'm like, it just freaks me out. Cause I'm like, well, in this kind of universe, what are the odds that this story of Jesus is true? You know, like what? Like it's incredibly stupid. It's like ridiculous. And yet, throughout my life, I've experienced it to be true. The truth of this story, I've experienced over and over and over again. And so to me, it's not like intellectually assenting to a set of theological propositions. It's just saying, like, in my life, I just keep being confronted by this, by the truth of this particular symbol system, because it's the symbol system that formed me, not this symbol system up and against the other ones. Like, this is the true ones. This is the true one and the others aren't. This is just the one I was born into. And it's like a really recent idea in human history that you can choose your symbol system, you know? But just the big T truth within it, this like I said, this perennial wisdom within it, I keep being confronted by the truth of it. So, that is very different than saying, you know, you have to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior and always believe this and follow all the rules and then you'll be saved. I mean, it's been cheapened. To me, it's been cheapened by that kind of idea. And it plagues people with, do I believe? Do I have faith? Do I have enough faith? The other thing is, like, I think faith is it's a team sport. It's not an individual competition. And so one reason for me to be in community is because I actually need the faith of other people. Mine is definitely insufficient. I always think, like, I don't know that God gives faith in sufficient quantity to any individual, but always gives it in sufficient quantity to a community. I mean, that those are very different ways of approaching this idea that don't plague us with, like, am I believing the right things and in the right quantity?
That's interesting. So would you say that, like, your faith is less about Jesus is the Son of God and more about there is grace?
Yes, both.
Like,
things.
What are you both? Like,
okay, so I think in terms of, like, when I'm talking about the perennial wisdom, big T truth that, like, everyone should be able to access because it's so incredible, that's the there is grace piece, right? Now, personally, I think Jesus in this, I know it sounds crazy because it's almost like being like, I also think the Easter Bunny is real. It's just like, for some reason, I don't know why, I have this faith that I think Jesus is the third member of the Trinity. I think God slipped into skin and walked around as this carpenter in Palestine 2,000 years ago and hung out with, like, all literally exactly all the wrong people. So I mean, yeah, I totally believe in that story. And then the crazy thing about like 3 days later, like killed 3 days later, literally resurrected. I'm so down with the literal story because that's just so crazy to me. And I think the whole thing was so embodied start to finish. Like the idea that God would make God's home in the womb of an insignificant peasant girl who was in a terrible life situation and didn't even have a place to stay. That story just kills me every time I hear it. So there's such a physicality to it that I'm like, no, man, I actually think there was a body at the end of it, like at the resurrection. It wasn't just an idea at the end or a feeling of the disciples. So I get how irrational it is to believe that, but that is like my personal faith. But it doesn't translate into this is the only true thing out there. If that makes sense. You know, I think prayer is prayer. I have an affection for so many different religious traditions and so many different forms of prayer. But I do believe that totally wackadoodle story. Yeah.
Well, doesn't that mean then that, let me say that differently. So just to be clear, when I was speaking, I didn't say the word God. I struggled with where did she get that from? Why is she saying that? Now I had time to reflect afterwards, and I looked through it, and you know, the bottom line is she's right. Like I know what I said, and I know what I believe, and I know I put my hope and love and faith in a place. Mm-hmm. And it's a really hopeful place. It's an unknown place in many ways, but it is a place, and it kind of relates to, because I tell a story which is about, you know, a little bit of tragedy and some redemption and some Frank, I'm a sinner and saint too. I don't use those words, but I say something along those lines. But I think the answer that she wants, and I think the correct answer in this case from me, is yes. Yes, you feel better for a good reason.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a perilous thing to like dare to speak about God, you know? And I think that there are ways of speaking about God without even using the name. And I think there are ways of talking about what I call the gospel without using that term or even mentioning Jesus. So to me, it all can be useful for people. Like, I don't feel like it has to be one symbol system or one way of speaking about it in order to be true, if that makes sense.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. What are you working on, like, personally?
Do you mean like my personal work, or you mean like what book are you writing right now?
No, I mean like you're like, because you just strike me as somebody who's so together, but I know that the reason you're so empathetic to others is because you're not together.
Yeah,
and you're
sure.
In touch with that. And so I wonder, in what ways are you not together? In what ways are you less than you wish you were?
Yeah. So I have a hard time with the fact that I can be sober this long, done this much personal work, you know, worked on Enneagram stuff, gone to seminary. Like I can do all of that, and yet my first reaction to almost everything is fuck you. Like I it's still there. Like that basic wiring, none of that stuff changes the basic wiring. And
I just gave the finger to an email this morning.
For sure, man. Like, I can go from zero to scorched earth so fast, you know? And so it's humbling to know that wiring is still there. Now, if the thing I'm really thinking about right now for myself is the story that I tell myself. And wondering, I just wrote a book on sex and Christianity and... and so I spent a year and a half interviewing people about what messages they received from the church about sex and the body. So I got to hear a lot of people's stories in that way. And I had to really dig into some of the stuff from my past that I'm not angry about anymore, but I had to look at it again and tell those stories. Like, I had to go to Christian charm classes It, mm-hmm. I know it shows. I know it does. But I like I found the workbook from when I was in these Christian charm classes that included things like a how feminine are you quiz and a calorie chart next to a Bible reading chart, right? I mean,
oh, it's... Oh, my God.
Correct. And so, so I ended up thinking, is there another story I could tell about that? Like, because there's so many different ways of speaking about the things that have happened to us in our lives. And we can become so attached to a certain way of telling the story that we reify the metaphor. And yep. So for I realized that that the women who were teaching that class, I actually have somewhat of a feeling of tenderness towards them, because in that fundamentalist church, you know, women couldn't even pray out loud in front of men. I mean, the gender thing was outrageous. But if your attractiveness, your prettiness, your, you know, humility of spirit, if all of those things, if that is the only currency you can trade in as a female in that system, there was some sweetness to the fact that there were women being like, baby girl, we're going to help you make the most of that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another way of looking at it. Like, nothing's ever only one thing. And mm-hmm. So it can have been a pernicious system of male domination that was being perpetuated and something kind of tender that these women were trying to help these girls make what they could of what they had. And there's a sweetness to that, too. Both those things can be true at the same time. And so
yeah.
I'm trying to notice when I tell myself the same story. And I got divorced a couple of years ago, and I really made this commitment to not just tell one story about my marriage, you know, and be like, it was hard and there were things that really were difficult, and it wasn't the wrong choice. Like, and he's a really good man and a good father, right? That two things can be true at the same time.
Yeah, we did a whole thing in the Neighborhood Project about and, not or.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And just recognizing that, like, classic narrative doesn't leave a lot of room for complexity or ambiguity or people who are kind of heroic but also pretty flawed, too.
Yeah, nor does Twitter. Know. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right? We're in this cultural moment where you're either all good or all bad. You know,
I know. And, you know, it's funny raising kids. I have always said to Georgia and Claire, you know, if they say always, never, everyone, no one, I kind of flag it like, really? Because mm-hmm. it's just so rare that it's everyone. And it's so rare that something is never.
Right. Right.
But there are all these words that we lean into.
Yeah.
Why do you think we're so hooked on conviction? Like, why do you think we like a story that to settle in on a story and like lock into it? And why is that so soothing?
Well, I quoted my friend Kelly Corrigan in my most recent book about this. I will always love that line you have, that we're a species of unreliable narrators desperate for closure.
Yeah.
It's like genius. Also, like, it's just easier in our minds, I think, to sort things into one of two categories. You know, binary thinking is just the easiest type of thinking, and it makes everything just more convenient. Like, you can move on to the next thing once you've settled on what category a person or an event or whatever falls into, right? But, like, the difference between, like, the type of Christianity that I'm preaching in my congregation and the kind I grew up with, and in a way really has to do with just either dualistic thinking or non-dualistic thinking in a sense. And of course, it's, I guess, a dualism to set it up like that. But this idea that, I mean, just like to go back to the beginning, we're all simultaneously sinner and saint, and living in paradox and holding two things in tension is a very difficult thing. But ultimately, there's so much more freedom in it, I think.
I know, yeah. But it is exhausting. It really is. It's like this, it tires your little brain out to have it be all messy like that all the time.
And you don't get to be the hero or the victim, right? And yes. I think we always want to either be the hero or the victim. And like, because I believe in grace so much, like, here's the thing. Grace is a double-edged sword, because if grace is real, then it means it's real for me and for everybody who's ever hurt me.
Right. Right.
Well, okay, now right. I feel differently about it, you know? That's like, I always say, like, with my luck, I'll be seated at the heavenly banquet between, like, Ann Coulter and some racist cop, you know?
Hey, Nadia, so what's the net of that in the following sense? Because I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, you know, so I'll give you some examples. Guilt, shame, fear, anger, lust.
You were feeling all of that listening to me?
Well, yeah, because here's what I'm actually thinking. Like, if I gave Nadia this test, like, scale of 1 to 10, how intense does your guilt get? Just give me an answer.
My guilt? Yeah. I don't have much. Yeah, maybe okay. 2.
Okay. Shame?
Yeah, I don't have a ton of that either.
Fear?
Not very much.
Anger?
Yeah, top of the scale.
You have a lot of anger. Yes. Interesting. Okay. And what about arrogance? Like,
yeah, I have a lot of that. Yeah.
Superiority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a lot of that too. Yeah.
Okay. I just learned a lot, I think, you know, because as you were describing that tension or whatever you call that mix of sinner and saint, you know, I was hopeful that, oh, that's how you feel less guilty and less shameful and less fearful and less angry and less all these other things. But that's, I bet there's some truth to that, some truth.
Yeah, because you know what? That's why people are just puzzled why I would write horrible things about myself in my books and say things on stage that people would be like, ooh, I would keep that to myself, you know? And I'm like, right. Because I don't have much shame about it. And I think the reason I don't have much shame about it is I really, really, really do believe in grace. Like, I actually believe there is this weird, some power greater than us that we can access that heals these things. And I think that when you have a really solid belief in grace, there's not nearly as much need for the shame. Why would you be ashamed of needing right. this thing that right. is like God's source code, you know?
Okay, so my next question has to be then, so why does the anger stick around?
Well, I think that's just personality. I mean, honestly, like, that's been my personality my whole life. So it's like, if you have a personality that's more wired for fear, then you can't look to me as an example for how to be, how to have less fear. I've never really been wired for it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So yeah. I think that's why I've really enjoyed studying the Enneagram in the last, you know, 15 years, because it's really just helped me look at, hey, people are just wired with different personalities, and that means we're going to have different struggles. You know, like, jealousy is not my go-to sin, right? But some people, it's a huge struggle for them. So we all have stuff that's going to be our life's work. You know, this is the stuff that's going to get in the way all the time. So I think if we realize that that's a wiring thing, and there's some good parts of it, and there's some challenging parts of it, we can see it for what it is. And it doesn't have to be in the driver's seat all the time. It's never going to go away. We don't have to have the expectation it's going to go away. But we don't have to hand it the keys.
And it's
one last thing. Yeah. Go ahead. You go, Kelly.
I was just going to say, it's like the key to empathy. I mean, if you didn't have this problem that was going to follow you to your grave.
Yeah.
Then you have sitting in front of a parishioner and they're telling you something and you can't even relate because you conquered your thing. Like, it's the key to your humanity and to mine and to Tom's and to everybody who's listening we can be forgiving because we have to learn to forgive ourselves for some pile of stuff that we can't quite shake.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's so much energy that we end up putting into trying to pretend our stuff isn't our stuff instead of like kind of making friends with it. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, you don't have to like all your friends. You know what I'm saying? But like the stuff I struggle with that's just always there on some level, maybe in the background, maybe in the driver's seat, my stuff, if I pretend it's not there, has so much more power over me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And if I go, okay, I see you, you know, I acknowledge you, I get that you're there, I'm not going to let you drive, but I'm also not going to pour a bunch of self-hatred into it, because that also ends up taking over, you know?
Yeah. I used to have panic attacks, and they said that when you start to feel like the tip of the iceberg, rather than turn your back to it and like let it chase you around for the next 20 minutes, just turn and face it and say, oh, there you are. Look at you. Right. And just that tiny bit of distance and, I don't know, not embracing it, but holding it.
Yeah.
Acknowledging it.
Yeah.
Is much less stressful than being chased.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. I agree.
You know, I saw Neil Phillips on Saturday. You remember Neil Phillips, Nadia?
Remind me.
He spoke about Visible Men last year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was great, yeah.
And he spoke on grace on Saturday. Mm. And it was beautiful. I think it was the most beautiful talk I've ever seen live. And maybe the most beautiful talk I've ever seen. I don't know. Oh, but I was incredibly moved. And he... you know, he referenced a trip that we had done with him down to Selma and Montgomery, and he went with John Lewis down to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, et cetera. And when our crew came back, they talked about how he was, you know, kind of quiet on the trip and whatnot. Well, what I've learned was he was sort of in awe, and he was, you know, he was really just in this super contemplative moment on that trip. And when he shared this, what he shared in this talk, it just so struck me, the power of that, what you said, this capital T truth. Like he's the benefactor of having experienced it, you know, as a person who's kind of thought about his place in the world vis-a-vis race intensely, you know, intensely. He's, you know, he's an American. He grew up in America, and he's a black man. Let me put it this way. I then had an experience, and I mentioned this to you this morning, where I did four gatherings right after that. And it was all sort of, it was up in Minnesota, sort of in the middle of nowhere. And it was coming off that experience. And what we had after that was this super intense analog thing. Four different groups right in front of each other's faces, lots of tears, lots of, you know, struggle, etc. And again, it's why I brought it up with you this morning. I mean, I think of that as your world. I think of analog as real, as human, as interactive, as a big part of your world. And I'm just wondering to what degree you agree, number one. And number two, how important is that to your own health or your own spiritual peace?
It is, in the sense that I am, you know, I'm still pastor of this little community in a really, like, if I'm in the country, I'm at church Sunday night, and that continues to be important to me. But also, I have a very, very, very private life. Like, I spend a lot of time by myself, a lot. And, you know, I live a sort of anonymous life privately. And then I have these women who I'm very close with who were all sort of in different ways, public faith leaders, and we're in contact with each other every day. I think there's 9 or 10 of us. We're on the phone with each other pretty much every day. We have a group text. We have decided to be 100% for each other, and that has really changed my life, because I think probably half the women in this group are women of color, and it's given me this. It's changed how I've experienced this life, to experience their lives alongside them in a way that reading a book never would have. And so I got to be at Spelman College a couple weeks ago. My friend Nichelle was installed as the dean of the chapel at Spelman College, historically black university. Spelman's a women's college across from Morehouse, which is a men's college. And I was the only white person in the room, and there was a way in which the physicality of being in that space, being on that holy ground of these historically black universities, and being able to honor this woman who has chosen to be my friend and to have me in her life, that's changed me in a way that listening to podcasts and watching documentaries and reading books never will, you know? And so I get to experience, loving someone and being present in their life who is a never once been thin sort of voluptuous woman moving through the world. I get to see what the world's like through her eyes and her body in a way that I never will if I didn't have that relationship and that commitment to love her. And there's a way in which this group of women has changed me in ways that I didn't even know. I didn't know what I didn't know, you know, until I got to see life through their eyes a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I do. I do know.
Is it a daily reprieve with you, Nadia?
With drugs and alcohol?
I kind of was speaking generally, but yeah, sure, specifically too.
Yeah, I mean, I constantly have that there, but for the grace of God, go I moment. And then I'm like, ooh, that's really bad theology. meaning, when something crashes and burns in someone's life, I don't have a feeling of smugness because it hasn't in my life. I feel like I dodged a bullet, right? Like, my kids are super solid, high-functioning kids. That's not superior parenting. You know, that was just luck in some ways. And so that's grace, right? There's been a lot of grace, and yet there's been a lot of struggle in the midst of it. It's never just one thing or the other. So in a way, I do sort of still rely on this power greater than myself just to kind of get through the day. And especially when I get into my stuff, if I get really angry, if I get really resentful, if I get a little bit ragey, I don't mean to sound pious, but honest to God, I was raging the other day and my boyfriend just looked at me, and he's not a religious, you know, he's not a Christian at all. And he goes, I know you've been ranting about the same thing for a few days, and I get how you're feeling, but like, have you just tried kind of praying about it? And he wasn't being an asshole. I mean, he was just really trying to help. And I just went, oh my God, I forgot about that. Like, I forgot that's an option. and then when my thoughts turn to this power that's greater than me, that's my source, it's my origin and my destination, this power that I call God, that when my thoughts turn to that, instead of turn to me and tied up in my selfish story, I keep wrapping myself up to tighter and tighter till I can't breathe. As soon as I turn my thoughts to that power that's greater than me, like, things untied themselves in my body, even. Like, it gave me a sense of relief that nothing else did. Just that moment of realizing and remembering, there's a source I can be drawing from that's not me, you know? Mm-hmm. And man, it helped.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they say about having awe in your life. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, going to the Grand Canyon or even just to the woods behind your house and looking at a tree. Or, I mean, it's very similar. You know, I'm not a religious person, but it's a very similar feelings I have when I'm in nature or on the water and looking at the ocean and being in a state of awe.
Yeah.
Or even being awed at a person right in front of me who's doing something miraculous. Mm.
Well, and I would say too, by the way, that's like, so I'm sitting at my desk, right? So that means I'm at work and that means I'm getting paid and that means I'm like, you know, well, I don't have to be any of those damn things right now. You know, what I'm actually doing is I'm having a conversation. What I'm actually doing is changing, and I'm lucky to be able to do this at this moment. And I have awe right now, like right at this very, very moment. Mm-hmm.
I had it this morning, honest to God, watching a video on Facebook that Jada Pinkett Smith is doing this video series with her mother and her daughter called the Red Table, Around the Red Table. And I'm not a big crier, but like I'll get struck by something and just start weeping. And Jada Pinkett Smith was having a conversation with the mother of Will Smith's first child, Trey, because they divorced and then Jada became his stepmom. And her and this woman have had a friendship or a relationship because of sort of co-mothering Trey for 20 years. And to hear them talk about what that was like and the struggles and to own their own stuff. And to, she said, Jada, you know, the thing is you would come to my house and every single time, if there was something to apologize for, you owned it. You said, I am sorry. And like, watching the love of these women and them talking about behaving poorly with themselves or their selfish reactions and knowing that that forgiveness and grace was there and seeing a clear love between them, I just started crying. It was beautiful. And so I had that feeling of like, oh my gosh, this thing is real, you know?
What a great place to end.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you, Nadia.
Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate you both.
Hope we see you soon.
Yeah, me too.
Have a happy day.
Bye, guys. This podcast and the Neighborhood Project are powered by the Nantucket Project.